Welcome to EPN Conversations. My name is Cameron Lackbar, and I'm joined today by my co-hosts,
Natalie Delamar,
Tim German,
Selvin Katukaran,
and our very special guest,
Shankar Vishwanathan.
Well, this is one of my great EPM conversations dreams come true. We have the man who owns the product that bought me my house. Because Shankar, your stewardship of Oracle planning is literally how I could afford my mortgage for my first house and my second house. So I want to
and sent my kids to college. Thank you, Shankar.
Never let it be said that you don't have an impact in our personal lives.
No worries. I think there's a lot of people there.
Beyond me. Mm-hmm. Yes. So for the rest of the audience, you might not know.
It's funny, Cameron. So I have seen a tomato which says mortgage breaker. So is that what Shankar is for us?
mortgage breaker. What are you talking about? So for the rest of our audience who might not know who Shankar is, Shankar, would you mind giving us an introduction?
Okay. I'll give you a start from where I am today, right? I'm a product management in charge for EPM cloud platform. It's kind of slightly different from what you had outlined as planning, right? I joined in as into Hyperion planning. My background really goes back into PeopleSoft and prior to that in consulting and in finance, but I joined into Hyperion planning and then was instrumental in launching PBCS, the first cloud within EPM. And then over the last couple of years, I've taken on more of a platform role, which is, we can get into that in kind of more of a Q&A, but it's beyond planning. It's more looking at the platform across the board with all the business processes within EPM, which leverage the EPM cloud platform. So that's really what I'm responsible for right now.
So if we could talk about, I'm always fascinated by the disconnect. Not everyone has, but many people have, between their formal education and what they've actually ended up doing for a living. What is your educational background? How on earth did you get into the software business?
I'll try to make it short, otherwise it'll go on for a long time here in this conversation. I started with accounting back in India. Bachelor's in commerce, as they call it in India, accounting degrees are not known as accounting, they're more commerce. And I actually did my, what the India counterpart for CPA is, it's a chartered accountancy, and also did my law and what they call as cost accounting. So I actually did those as part of my education. And then I was working in Pricewaterhouse before I moved to the US to actually actually came here to do a PhD in finance and almost finished with it before I decided I'm not made for academia. And I used that time to finish up my CPA and actually got into corporate finance. I was trying to choose between investment banking and corporate finance, and I also did the CFA at two levels. But I got into corporate finance, so with all the visa things, which you can kind of don't want to get into that details, but kind of landed in corporate finance. I was in New York actually working with an oil company, headquartered based out of New York with branch offices in Dallas and Houston. But actually I was handling all their 10K reporting. So more consolidation and reporting, as a matter of fact, is where I got started in this. So that kind of led to, you know, them implementing Hyperion Enterprise in-house. They didn't call any consultants. They just pointed to me and said, you do it. So I was responsible for implementing Hyperion Enterprise. That was in the 90s. And that caught on the bug of, you know, consulting as an implementation approach. And then I went from there to Revelwood, which is at that time, they were based out of New York. Downtown Manhattan. I did consulting in TM1, OutlookSoft, which is what it was called at that point.
I remember them. Yeah.
Yeah, so that was my primary gig, OutlookSoft and TM1. And Revelwood was really strong in TM1, so I learned a lot from them. With the colleagues, I had a really great bunch of colleagues there. I think 9/11 was where it kind of shifted, right? I think 9/11, I was actually right there in 9/11.
Oh, you were in Manhattan?
I was right there next to World Trade Center. Oh. I think after heading into a consulting assignment in downtown Manhattan. I think after that, the consulting that year kind of fell into a lull in Manhattan.
I remember.
Things were not moving, I think, if you remember. And we were on those, base pay plus percentage of billable kind of gig. And then I think our first daughter was born just 2 days after 9/11. So that kind of led me to look elsewhere to see if there's any alternatives for more stability or so that's where I kind of got into PeopleSoft product strategy out there in the West Coast. And at that point, I think I wanted to get out of New York City, the 9/11 and stuff. So that's kind of where my segue into the current role, right? I joined PeopleSoft and then went through the Oracle acquisition, quit, joined Hyperion. And then here I am still.
Did you start out at Hyperion as a consultant? Were you doing field implementation?
No. Actually, I was also already into the development, right? With PeopleSoft, I was in product strategy. And then from there, I moved to Hyperion product management. So if different companies view different things, this role kind of differently. So that's how I kind of got into product management in Hyperion.
So did you leave PeopleSoft after the acquisition by Oracle? And then immediately join another company that got acquired by Oracle.
Yeah, that's kind of true, Tim.
So you couldn't, no escape.
No escape. Yeah, actually, I could foretell, right? You know, I went through the whole PeopleSoft acquisition. It was a pretty kind of a quasi-hostile takeover, if you remember those times. And I was in all those discussions between various teams in Oracle and trying to decide which features were told good and you know, which teams were told good going forward. And I just was wanted to something smaller, a tighter knit group. So that's where I went into Hyperion. I looked out for something in the same area. Actually, I was handling consolidation in PeopleSoft, not planning. And I was also looking for a change from consolidation because I had done implementation and consolidation and then product strategy and consolidation. So I was looking for a change. So that's how I landed up in planning. Luckily, Hyperion had opening and planning product management at that time.
What did you think of working for Hyperion? I'm not trying to compare it against Oracle, but I have talked to a bunch of ex-Hyperion people, and almost to a person, they loved it. Described it as the greatest. One person I know has described it as the greatest job I've ever had. I don't know. Is that you know? Nostalgia speaking, or was it a special place to work?
I think I wouldn't say it was, right? It still is in a way, because I didn't come from that acquisition merger of Arbor and Pillar, all that, confluence into what they called Hyperion in the early 2000s starting. I wasn't part of that history. So I came in new. And I was part of PeopleSoft, which had, for folks who remember PeopleSoft, had probably one of the best enterprise warehouse architectures around that time. So I was exposed to a lot of big schema, big deployment kind of architecture. So my entry into Hyperion wasn't as people who came in from that Arbor or Pillar background who had that nostalgia to hold on to. I was used to multidimensional from my consulting days, so I was happy to get back into that. But that's where I came in. I came in with a totally fresh outlook for things, or my background was different from many people I worked with. But just going back to your, I think your statement about Hyperion being the best place to work, I think the reason I'm still here is we are still the same group. We are still agile. We are still most folks. The folks who run things or manage things are still more or less same. A lot of people have left or moved on, but the core group is still somewhat the same, at least the people I interact with, right? So people talk about, oh, how come you're still at Oracle? But to me, Oracle is not in my purview as a company. It's about the people I work with and the people I deal with on a day-to-day basis and whether I'm able to get the stuff done for my customers. That's all that matters, and that's what keeps me active every day. That's what, you know, is my motivation every day. It's and that's pretty much it. I mean, I try to keep it simple. As long as people I work with are enthusiastic about the software improvements and I'm able to get stuff done for our customers, I try not to get involved in what's happening in the broader Oracle, because the only thing that matters to me is what involves my work. Hopefully that answers your question. So it's still, it wasn't a was, it is still a good place. I like the people I work with, and it's still, I see a lot of posts and, you know, out there from in the broader community about Hyperion in general. But to me and the people I work with, that community still exists within. In terms of how we work and how we deal with issues and how we work with customers, right? So that's and that's really what keeps me here still.
So you feel like the EPM community within Oracle is almost like a company within a company, and so you have like your own unique little culture within that EPM.
I would say so. I would say so. I was used to PeopleSoft. PeopleSoft had a very open culture. And I talked to friends who are being with me in PeopleSoft who moved on to Workday. I could have easily moved on to Workday at that time. And that was my first exposure, right, to a bigger company with PeopleSoft, because I was in consulting before that. And coming into Oracle, I saw it growing much bigger. So Hyperion was kind of this, and it also comes down to product management, how it works, which is how different companies handle product management and their roles. I'm more hands-on. I like to be closer to the software, and Hyperion let me do that and allowed me that opportunity to interact on both sides of the table with customers, with partners, and with the sales consultants, with development at the same time. So it's a full 360 degree angle you get, whereas in a bigger setup you don't get that. In PeopleSoft, they separate out product strategy with product management being different. I think Workday still continues with that paradigm. Different companies handle it differently, but this is what I like. I think the people I work with are enthusiastic with what they do. And to answer your question, Natalie, it is a culture within Oracle. I don't know other cultures within Oracle might be similar, but I know that this is more agile than other things I hear about or get to see within Oracle. So it is unique in that respect, and that's something which is what keeps me active every day.
It's interesting that you mentioned that you're more hands-on, because that's something which we always talk about. Shankar, even though he is known as a PM, you are more technical. We always thought you and Prasad should actually switch the roles because you are more technical. We have always talked about that. It's funny you mentioned that you're more hands-on. Do you like it that way, or is it just your nature of working earlier as hands-on? That is it comes like just naturally?
Oh, no. Just to answer your question on the Prasad analogy, I think Prasad is way more technical. He's obviously there for that reason. I'm actually, as you know, my background, I just explained it, it's more in finance and accounting. Yeah. So I picked my techno functional, more functional than technical. But I think all my learning from accounting comes into play when I do products like strategic modeling and deal with the more intricate use cases. But hands-on, what I meant by hands-on is more being closer to the software. I mean, I can tell you two examples of how product management works, right? Product strategy versus product management, or you can call it product management outbound versus inbound, right? So outbound would be where companies like PeopleSoft or even in Workday might be separating out the function of somebody who interacts with the customers, get their requirements and understand how they use the software, and versus somebody who's more of a functional analyst working closer to development. So there's a kind of a dividing invisible line, which you kind of give off your requirements to somebody else who then doesn't really interact with customers, but designs the product with the development. Here you get to do both sides. And from my experience, I think it's, there is obviously, I've done all sides of the product management. PeopleSoft, I was more strategy oriented, doing the outbound more and the pricing and taking care of those areas. I've done that in Hyperion also to a large extent around the time PBCS was launched. But I think in general, for a customer to be happy, you really need a good oversight over the development cycle from a product management standpoint. That's where the crux of the rubber meets the road, right? I mean, I think in that sense, I like Elon Musk's philosophy of if the product is good, it speaks for itself. And you don't need to market it. You don't need to go tell how it's doing. It speaks for itself, right? So it's the same holds good for software too. So there are specific areas within the software, which everybody, no matter which software it is, whether it's a banking software, your app, anything, right? There are basic things which people look out for in terms of performance, in terms of usability. And those are the two kind of foundational aspects of any software. People don't use it if either of those two are not good enough, right? So to your question, Sullivan, it's more about being closer to the software and navigating that ship, right? I mean, it's like a train. If you don't take care of it, it's going to go move on to the next station. That's how development works.
Yeah.
And they're going to move on. And then it's your role, if you don't have enough sufficient oversight at that point, to make sure the going is good, you kind of have to explain why it's not so, right? And that becomes a challenge. And it's not easy to explain that to customers. So it's important. This part of product management to me is kind of the crux of it, right? Because everything else comes later. So you need that close collaboration and working relationship with the developers and the development lead. So different people work differently with development teams. I tend to be more focused on every aspect of the development cycle, which means I'm interacting with I know some developers, I know their food habits as well, right? So it's as close as being to the person who's actually coding and respecting them in that role and making sure they're aware of how important their role is in how customers use it, right? So although they're so separated from that point. So that's what I meant by hands-on, is being close to the product so that you may not get everything you want, but you at least are able to have oversight and navigate it to the extent necessary.
So you talked about how unique that culture is for product management and product development for EPM at Oracle. And you also talked about your background being finance and accounting, which I think probably lends itself to providing a better product strategy and roadmap to your clients. But I'd love for you to speak about that. Is that typical? Because I would think most product managers come up from the technology side and not the finance and accounting side. But I'd love to hear how is your EPM product management at Oracle? Is that typical for Oracle that the product managers come from a more functional background? And is that different from other typical software vendors' product management groups?
No, I think it's more about the EPM field, which lends itself to the functional background. If you look around Oracle, there is obviously a lot more leaning towards technical product management. If you go to analytics or OCI, you find a lot more technical depth. It's not like we can't or I cannot cover technical aspects, but the functional aspects, because you're day in and day out interacting with customers who are using your software and they're using it for either finance or S&OP or anything which is functionally related, right? So when they are talking, you need to be able to visualize yourself in their shoes and be able to understand what they're going through, either it's positive or negative outlook they have. You need to be able to put yourself in their shoes and imagine yourself in their shoes working the way they do. And that can come more easily if you have been in the background of functional background, like in my case, right? So if somebody's explaining, for example, a problem with funding options or debt scheduling, which are more very intricate finance aspects, you can relate to it because I can easily understand what they're talking about because it's accounting at the end of the day, right? And you can understand if there's a pain point, then you can easily relate to that pain point. But if not that you cannot do it if you're technical, but given that techno-functional background, given that experience has given me that technical background to understand what they're talking about and how that translates to a product feature or an enhancement or an issue, and how you have to be able to translate that very quickly in your own mind, how that translates into a development work, where that can fit into the roadmap or how much the scoping effort would be. And that's something you may not, you have to go through that exercise later, but the experience gets you to understand what the customer pain point is, how soon do they need it, what does it take to get you there, and based on the current pipeline and bandwidth which developers have, what would be the best way to get that out to the customer, right? So those 360-degree angle viewpoints can be more, I think, easier if you have that functional background, which is necessary in EPM, I think.
How much of your time is spent talking to customers?
Quite a bit, actually. I talk to customers all the time. It's because we do presentations, obviously, at KScope and other conferences and outbound. We do have user groups, which I don't go to more as much as I used to before. But in the cloud, we have a pretty good assessment based on the analytics we do of what customers are doing and where they stand. So I get involved in a lot of escalation calls with customers or, you know, feedback calls. So if there is, customers logged enhancements, which we don't understand, I usually just get on the phone with them and chat with them. It's funny or it's interesting how easy it is to reach out to customers as just individuals, right? It's all a rapport at that point. For you to just have that one-on-one conversation, because at the end of the day, I have done their job and I want to understand what they're doing in their job. And so it's, every day is a learning to me to understand that and gain from that, right? Every day I learn something new and hopefully they're learning something in that process conversation. So I'm never hesitant to talk to a customer, to any user that they are from their IT section or from their business user groups.
How many of those conversations start with Cloud Customer Connect now? Because that seems like a really positive development that you can just submit a feature request on Cloud Customer Connect and other customers can comment on it and so on. And like that's definitely it seems like a great channel that is relatively recent, right?
Oh, yeah, that's definitely a huge plus. We can easily track what customers are asking for. We have analytics on the Cloud Customer Connect through which we can see where more popular requests are coming from. Sometimes, obviously, those are skewed in the sense that, not the bigger customers may not all, or the smaller products in both those cases, they may not get as much visibility, which means that if an idea is required by a bigger customer who has larger impact within their organization, but the idea itself is not popular among many other customers, it may still get visibility within our group, right? Because of the fact that the scale of impact and the industry impact it has. So we look at multiple things, not just about Customer Connect, but also what's the customer situation like in their implementation cycle or what's their standing in the industry and how the ripple effect, as I call it, right? How big an impact would be if this feature is given across the industry, right? So we look at multiple angles to it before we decide to deliver something. So yeah, so to answer your question, Tim, Customer Connect has definitely made our job and lives much easier. It definitely is a very strong place from which we gather requirements and the primary place, I would say, but it's not the only one.
Hmm. Yeah. What are those other areas, Shankar, that you're, I would assume you're doing competitor analysis, right? And looking at that and what's being offered by your competitors as well as what customers are asking for, as well as innovation. So how do you balance those three things as to what's going to go into the roadmap?
I think it's, I mean, there's emphasis on all of them, right? I mean, as any other companies would do, it's a similar focus on, but it's not, we don't go feature by feature looking at who's doing what and trying to do the same thing. We are more focused on making sure, is that, how's that benefiting our customer? And the ripple effect is a common theme I run in my mind, and others do too. In terms of how many other customers will benefit from it, is it a long-term benefit? And if there are more customers benefiting and going to be using it, then it's a natural competitive edge. We don't really look at things in terms of looking over our shoulders. If I'm driving my car, I'm not really driving it thinking who else is driving on the left lane and right lane. Can I overtake them? So it's, I got to focus on my road and my rear view and making sure our customers are happy. Primarily, and the innovations in terms of, the market needs from an innovation standpoint, those are being addressed. But the CI aspect is there when there are things which some other vendor may have done better. We do to look at this, but I mean, different people have different perspective. My perspective is the customer's happy, they speak for you, right? This going back to the Elon Musk analogy, if the product can speak for itself because your customers are happy with it, they will champion it.
Yeah, and I think that it's reflected in the recent rankings that just came out from Gartner on both planning and consolidations, that you guys are ranked highest, I think, of any other vendor in both those categories. So congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think it's a big ownership, right? I mean, we have 7,000 plus customers across EPM wide, and when you're responsible for the platform in EPM, you touch every aspect of everybody's life. And my philosophy there is a customer is not a company. It's the user within that company who is using it. And they don't come into work because they want work with your software. That's not why they work, right? They have their own day job. Our software's job is to make sure their lives are easier to do what they want to do. That's kind of the core thumb rule I kind of use on a day in and day out basis, is how can I make their life easier? I may succeed some days I don't. But that's, I mean, that's what keeps me focused, is making sure if all users are happy, then the product speaks for itself. So it's a big responsibility. If you have 7,000 plus customers, fleet of customers, you want to, and many times, like the Forms 2.0, Dashboards 2.0, it influences a lot of customers all in one, all at once, right? So those are things which we definitely take seriously in terms of how we roll out stuff.
It's got to be a little scary.
It is. Yeah. It is, but we definitely, yep.
So it's an interesting thing that, Shankar, you talked about it as a platform. Usually people don't think of PBCS or ePBCS as a platform, because it's like a solution or a product. So is that like a marketing thing that you guys need to do? And the other question is, since you talked about it being on different other products as a platform, will we see ePBCS on other Oracle products, like how Essbase is now under the database and Fusion and everything? Will we in the future see that?
We don't see it as a product because obviously first it evolved over the time, right? ePBCS was launched as a product by itself in 2014, but over time, since 2019, we have evolved as a platform into which we plug in other applications, our business processes, as we call it, right? So we don't really use acronyms anymore. People who are within the Oracle framework essentially know it. I know there's a lot of partners who still are accustomed to using the old acronyms, but we don't use acronyms. We refer to them in the functional context of closed tax planning, profitability, and freeform. So those are acronyms which are still in the community, but we don't use them. So they all plug into PBC has kind of evolved, right? Because we started with that as the first cloud launch, but that became the platform into which others are plugging in now. Platform itself evolves, right, over time, like Enterprise Journal is something which the Country Constellation uses, but that becomes over time as more business processes within EPM use it, that becomes a platform capability, right? So those are things, and IPM, for example, is also something similar where as we innovate further into areas, those become more platform components, which more and more customers can leverage across these business processes. So yeah, so going back to your question about EPBCS being going beyond, it's the platform is central to EPM, right? So EPBCS or planning, as I would call it, because the PBCS is just EPBCS. Those are just nomenclatures in terms of modules or non-modules, but they're all planning in the final customer perspective, right? You're planning, using it for planning.
Let me follow up on Selvin's question, because I think, yes, it's no longer PBCS. It hasn't been PBCS for literally years. But maybe the question is more platforms interacting with platforms. You know, PBCS, to use the obsolete term, that I can remember when there were other products, and of course now I can no longer remember it, where everything had a PBCS name in the URL. That was a product that became a platform. I guess it was, to your point, the first offering. I would even say product, the first offering in the cloud for EPM, Oracle EPM.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What happens when a cloud ERP bumps up against a cloud EPM instance? How does that work both internally, right? How does that work within Oracle, as much as you can tell us? And then how does that work at the customer level?
I think it's, there's obviously, I think this is obviously announced in a lot of K-Scope presentations in terms of the integration. So we don't need to get into the mechanics of it. The integrations are pretty seamless between the platform doesn't, over time, we might extend it to more common platform across ERP, EPM, but those we don't have a need to do that because we have a lot of customers who are non-Oracle, right, coming from the Hyperion days who are SAP and non-Oracle ERP, right? So there is a need to keep that a distance for those customers also. And for folks who are using ERP, we are doing a lot of efforts in those integration to make them seamless from a data interactivity, metadata, and also from a security standpoint. So those efforts are ongoing. But I think we kind of, based on 7,000 plus customers, we address a lot of customers' needs beyond just Oracle as an ERP, which is why EPM as a platform resonates with many of them. My statement on the platform is more, I mean, I think to me, platform needs to be open architecture, which means a more REST-based interface to a lot of external plug-and-play solutions. And that's where we are putting a lot of effort on in terms of the platform capabilities. Not just on EPM, which is already a defined platform, but going more towards making plug-and-play for many other customers who want to do, because we don't control a lot of what customer decisions are in terms of what they have already done in terms of organization-wide setup, let's say for reporting. So those are use cases we try to make sure, right, are addressed through the platform.
That is so interesting. So we will, at a future state, we could create like software on top of planning where you use REST API to interact with it. Is that kind of where it's headed?
I think that's what Tim Toe has been asking for a long time, right, Shankar?
No, I think what I meant is like, let's take a Power BI or Tableau. There might be, mm-hmm. you know, C-level decisions made ahead of time in many companies, which we don't influence. But they do need to work seamlessly with our software, right? So we want to make sure that those use cases coming through are addressed to make sure when they deploy our solution, we are just part of the ecosystem within their organization. So we want to make sure they are working seamlessly, right? So those need to work beyond just the Oracle side of things.
Gotcha.
That makes a lot of sense because a lot of clients have made big investments in analytical platforms and they want to be able to pull that EPM data without moving it, right, and be able to visualize it. So I completely agree with that approach. Yeah.
Yeah. And being in Oracle helps us because we have a lot of technology middleware we can take advantage of in terms of the database technologies, which we can leverage. So our technology under the covers is always evolving, right? We rather than stick to what Hyperion was, I mean, to sell into your earlier question, it can evolve over time, right? I mean, there is things can change over time. When we launched PBCS, I think it was Anaplan who called us old wine in a new bottle. Those phrases will keep going on, but we evolve internally from a technology standpoint, from a UI interface technology standpoint. All of that, obviously, you must have heard of Redwood. So a lot of things are happening within Oracle, in the broader Oracle ecosystem, which we can decide to choose as our technology pathway where it needs to be based on the user needs of EPM users, right? So that's the benefit of being in a larger ecosystem like Oracle, that you can take advantage of the technology innovations going across the board in Oracle and leverage to the extent necessary for your benefits within your EPM business processes to benefit our customers, while still staying from a development standpoint, still staying agile and true to our customer needs.
Do you think that being part of is Oracle the third biggest technology company in the world? Maybe. I can never get the numbers straight. Do you think that you worked for Hyperion? Hyperion was a standalone company. I mean, it was a while ago, right? So I understand that lots of things have changed. But being part of, does Oracle EPM, has it gone different directions? Like, I'll get this question out sooner or later. Has it gone off in different directions because it's part of a larger overall technology company? I mean, if Oracle EPM was its own company, I don't know, whatever the name of that company would it be doing the same things? The need is the same, right? It's the same customer base, at least roughly. Would it be different?
I don't know. Cameron, that's a hypothetical. I don't have a good answer to it. Yeah. But I think, I mean, to kind of allude to that, there are different scales, right, of customers in terms of we have the small, medium, and large level of customers. Then if you break it down by industry, different use cases across those three segments of customer types, right? And we have NetSuite, for example, which leverages EPM business processes for their customer segment, which tends to be the medium-sized companies. So I think we have touched all of those segments in some way or fashion. And we have, from a product management standpoint, that's where it becomes a little challenging or rather interesting to make sure that you are able to not just meet the needs of the big guys, but also of the medium and small guys, because they are out there, right? An average NetSuite user base is around 20 users. So you still have to make those users happy while still making sure that 3,000 plus user customer is also happy. I don't know if that answered your question, but I think that's what I was trying to get at, is that we still... I think the crux of what I'm trying to say is that Oracle benefits us being as part of that more broader ecosystem to leverage the technology innovations which go on in the broader Oracle, while this EPM being within Oracle, but as a more cohesive unit, allows us to be agile and address across those scale of customers. I think that's and that's a balance which we always have been trying to do over the last 15 years, and we keep progressing towards that perfection.
Yeah, I have to say that when I was in the Oracle space, I never thought about the rest of Oracle. I mean, this could have been my limitations or blindness or whatever. I always just thought of it as Oracle EPM or Hyperion EPM before that. It just never clicked.
I think that's a benefit, right? I mean, if you think about machine learning and AI, for example, I mean, that's a pure play technology aspect, which we can decide, hey, we have the functional use cases, we can define them, and then go start talking to people, other teams who have the bandwidth, who have the bench strength to innovate purely from a technology angle, and then define those use cases and leverage their technologies to the extent it's necessary for us. So I think that's a good benefit of being an Oracle.
You know, you mentioned AI. So Sylvan and I were at a conference a while back where it was just AI everywhere. And buzz phrases come and go, and trends come and go as well. If you stick around long enough, I don't know if the old saying, everything that's new is old again, or everything that's old is new again. I don't know that I totally believe that or agree with it. But there's an awful lot of talk about it. I personally was incredibly skeptical of it. Sort of the joke is we can't handle normal intelligence. We don't have much of it. So how is artificial intelligence going to work with us? I've used it in my job. I've used the freebie ChatGPT, GPT that comes with Bing. It's incredible. And of course, this is not for financial stuff. This is really for analytical stuff, for want of a better term. I have to say that it's like a cheating fifth grader who turns in his school homework and had it written by ChatGPT. I don't have it write my homework, but I do bounce ideas off of it, and it's simply amazing. I'm sure you hear it. What's your take on the actual applicability for the EPM customer base?
Yeah, I would speak beyond Oracle in general. I think it's evolving, right? Gen AI is kind of early 2023, it's really changed it's a paradigm shift in terms of how people look at AI and ML in general. But I think it's an evolving area in terms of its ability to handle data types in terms of numeric versus non-numeric data types. So it's still evolving. Some are not so good, some are better in terms of numeric, but I think most of them are pretty good with non-numeric data. I think it's important for us to not lose sight of the fact that it's customers and their use cases which need to define what we need to do with it. I mean, I know there's a lot of, everybody needs to post something and say something about it. Otherwise, you left people think that you're not there talking about it. But any of those, and it applies like any other technology, right? You have to take it to your customers' use cases, and use cases and problem statements define how you apply those technologies. And you can innovate the heck out of it, but you need to stick to that, basic framework that what are you solving for this user? How are you making their life easier? Not just doing it for the sake of doing it. I think there's a lot of, if you think from that angle, there is a lot of opportunities there. Some may not be having that sizzle and appeal to go present in a conference that, hey, I'm doing this with AI, or post in a LinkedIn post and say, how cool is this? Something doesn't need to be cool to solve a customer problem. It needs to address their day-to-day problems, right? It may not be that kind of K-scope wow factor or keynote presentation. It's, in my opinion, it's okay. Others may differ in their opinions on that. But in my opinion, it needs to solve the day-to-day use cases. Otherwise, what's the point? If I'm just going to showcase something and not really solve a real problem, And I think if you think, and you have to evolve with the technology, right? As it stands a year from when it got announced in early 2023 or late 22, there are use cases which can be solved today. You don't need to wait for the technology to solve the numeric data type problems for us. And there are plenty of those problems which can be solved today for our users across the board, right? And I think that's where our attention is initially. And then and we keep trying out how it will address more esoteric problems, which involve number crunching and numerical analysis. So those would be typical finance use cases would want it to solve, but I think it's evolving in that direction. It's not there yet.
You talked about KScope, and you've got three former board members on this call and two former presidents. Selvin somehow missed the madness. God, as always.
Don't fool me. Like, not fool me yet.
Oh, I'm sorry. Tim, you have what is it, 12th? So, yeah, still have time. You're not done yet. What's the value to you? Natalie and Tim need to definitely, they have a different perspective than I did. I was never, thankfully, president. What's your perspective on the value of user groups, especially, you know, after the Great Plague happened, so many things shifted. In the consulting world, they certainly shifted a lot. Do conferences still have the same value they had before? Do they serve the same role?
I think they do. I mean, if you look at pre-KScope, pre-COVID versus post-COVID, and the enthusiasm in this last session of 23 at KScope, there's a significant value to face-to-face interaction and people actually seeing somebody talk and explain the technical aspects of their presentation live with the emotions and motions. So there is significant value to that face-to-face presence. And KScope is a unique place where enthusiasts get together to a more quasi-technical conference rather than a cloud world where it's more business-centric, which is great. A different set of user groups go there. But the core enthusiasts still benefit a lot from being at KScope. And I think there's a lot of value to your question in KScope. Because we definitely missed having that face-to-face presence during the KScope. I think we did it over the web, and that wasn't fun at all. I think people start losing attention when you start presenting at these big conferences over the web.
Yes,
I want to go back to the comment around AI and my perspective on AI and the intersection of EPM. I think 5 or 6 years ago, you know, I work for PwC and we would talk to finance people around AI and they just would roll their eyes at us, right? And now clients are actually wanting to discuss the intersection of machine learning and planning. I think they're realizing the value, especially since there is a huge push to drive costs out of finance, right? And to get more efficient and to get information faster. And I've seen clients, stand up IPM, which is the, you know, machine learning tool within the platform, specifically within the planning business process, within less than 4 months, which is pretty amazing to leverage innovation or new technology. So I think it used to be like, okay, this is not real and finance people will never adopt it. And now I'm seeing finance people are asking for it and they want it. And they want to see the innovation coming in the software. So I'm really excited about where IPM is going with Oracle. And I'd love to hear your perspective of what's next, Shankar, with IPM within the platform.
Yeah, I don't want to go into the detailed roadmap here, but I think we are looking at a lot of things in that area in terms of multivariate analysis for time series. And there is a lot of, as I said, we are doing a lot of research around the Gen AI and using that in this context and what are the use cases we can solve. So there's definitely innovation happening in that area. But as I said, going back to my statement, Natalie, so we have to focus on what is the problem statement and then have solutions. There's technology solutions for a lot of things. Some of them may not be as, some of them may be cool, but they may not be necessary to solve a problem statement. So we have to kind of balance it, and that's what we are doing to make sure we solve real use cases based on what customers are facing. And a lot of times in finance community, and this is not just about Oracle in general, you're going to have data integrity or we call it data security issues, right? Because once you have ML models where you have to pipe your data out of your own applications, there is concerns, right? So we have to keep those in mind when we try to solve these use cases. And that's probably the biggest bridge to cross within EPM. And this applies no matter which company you talk to, Oracle or any other vendor in this space, is the data security issue, right? Because it's easier to do it with data which is out there in the public domain, but it's much more trickier. And you got to be really careful when it comes to data security and from an organization perspective.
You know, it's funny when you talk about change and security. If I think back to the beginning to PBCS, to 2014, the resistance I heard from people about putting their company's data into the cloud, I had a very limited number of clients, but all of my clients said, no way. And now, of course, it's really not a discussion, is it? I mean, it just is. It is across multiple vendors. It is the standard. It is interesting to see how quickly those opinions change. What do you put that down to? Is it just the fear of the unknown? Is it thinking that doesn't change quickly enough? Because if it didn't work, it would really not have worked by now. I mean, everyone does it. And I don't even forget EPM. I don't go to a bank, right? I mean, all of my personal banking information is at my bank's website. I can go get it. I don't think anything about it.
I think it's just a learning process, right? I mean, if you go back, just taking EPM and our own space aside, if you go back to, you used to hand your credit cards to your restaurant waiter, they go into some space, swipe it somewhere, come back and give you, and you don't know what they did with it. They took an imprint of it, right? So there is a trust element you had even before, even when we had Google email or Gmail come in, there was this trust element in cloud in our own personal spaces, which I think it takes a little more effort to translate into an organizational trust, because it has to have multiple tiers of validation before organizations start trusting the cloud, public cloud. And that comes over time as you see more of your peers go into the public cloud domain and see that they are secure. And also on the flip side, you have instances like, you know, if it's not cloud, is it not hackable? Like the Sony instance, which I think all of us know of the big hack many years back. So it's not like just because you don't have it in the public domain, your data is safe. So it's more safe when there are companies which are very focused on making sure your data is secure, because that is their bread and butter, to make sure your data is secure. Right? For Oracle, it is of paramount importance to make sure every customer's data is safe. And so they put a lot of effort and technology to make sure that's the case. But if I were running my own internal cloud, then it may not be my only focus, right? That's just another cost component in my budget. So I think to answer your question, it is a matter of, first of all, a personal trust issue translating into an organizational trust, which takes time for that validation to occur across various sizes of organizations. And then secondly, it's more about just getting that assurance that public cloud vendors are putting in a lot of effort into making sure your data is secure.
Yeah, the smaller players seem to buy that. They say, well, we're not cloud. We have a cloud product, but we're not a cloud provider. And they essentially outsource it, contract it, whatever the right term for it is.
There are so many pieces, right? I mean, we have, you know, data centers, which may be a company like Equinix may be running the data center. So there are so many, places of exposure. And everybody has to play their part. Just because you have everything, a data owned within non-public cloud, doesn't ensure that it is secure. So there's, I think those two aspects which I mentioned, but the trust aspect, which is takes more time when it's non-personal, when it's organizational, just because the validation efforts are more. Because you would trust your Gmail, you trusted that from what, mid-2000? Five or something, right? You didn't question at that time, but when it comes to an organizational data, there's more effort and validation needed across and acceptance needed before you go into public cloud. And I think secondly, as I mentioned, making sure organizations like Google or Microsoft or Oracle put in a lot of effort and time and resources into making sure data is secure, right? So that's that gives them confidence and assurance to people.
So if it's not security, you know, if the security issue is generally accepted to be solved, you're committed to supporting on-prem customers for a long time, like almost another 10 years, I think. What is still, for the relatively small number of on-prem customers, what is keeping them there in your view?
I think it's the same thing discussion we just talked about. The hesitancy is more organizational in terms of not. I think it's you probably see it more in the banking sector, although I've seen a lot of banks over the last 7 years shift over to public cloud. Mm-hmm. But you see there is an element of risk which you don't want. Because you know what you have today works and it's working well for your company, right? Why? It's like the pottery barn principle, like this, right? Why break what's already working? Why try something? Because there's so much at stake in your data in certain industries that you don't want to jump. But I think that is shifting, right? Because it's over time, it just takes time in some industries more than others and in some sizes of companies on. It's also depends on the culture of the companies going top down in terms of how much they are ready to take that risk, right? I mean, yeah. If you go to the defense sector, for example, defense companies are probably going to be more resistant for a longer duration to take that leap of faith into a cloud.
Yeah, completely agree. I had a client, one of my A&D clients, they wanted to make sure they were on FedRAMP too. So for those of you who don't know, like there's different levels of security. And I think the federal government requires a specific level and they wanted the Oracle to be certified at that level of security because of the fact that they were defense contractors. So, but even them, we're seeing more of those clients being willing to move as well. I think the only barrier I'm seeing as a, you know, at one of the big fours is the investment. Some people just don't want to pay the cost to do a project. And they don't quite see the ROI yet in moving because they have such large investments and they're going to have to put out a lot of capital. And a lot of capital is more better spent in other areas that's going to drive the top line. So I don't think it's anything left with the question of security much anymore. It's more around, do we have the capacity from a people perspective? Because it's going to take resources, right? I'm going to have to deploy resources from existing projects or existing efforts to go do this thing, and is it really going to drive a bottom line impact? And a lot of clients might not see that it's worth it right now. So it's just a timing issue because eventually they're going to have to move.
Sure.
So I'm going to switch gears and Shankar, I'm the only woman on this podcast, and a lot of times when we have women and we interview women who sit in technology and who are in this space, we ask them about how do you do it? How are you a mom and you do technology? So I just heard for the first time, I didn't know you had children. I just heard you talk about your first daughter. I'd love to hear if you're willing to share about how you balance being a parent and working in a field like technology, which can be very demanding, especially when you were on the consulting side.
I think it's fine. I don't see much of a problem there. Obviously, my kids are growing up right now. my wife is obviously she plays a big role in all of this. So we kind of tandem together in making sure our kids during their growing years were taken care of by balancing our functions in terms of who takes on what responsibility. So I think it's definitely a challenge for I would say just Natalie for women. I would want to see more women in technology and more, especially in development. I see in our development, there's obviously not as many, but I see more and more youngsters coming into technology who are women, and we want to see more of that, right? So it definitely helps broaden the spectrum from an adoption standpoint.
And same thing for product management, right? Because I know you talk about development, but just thinking over the case scopes, and you know, we love our product managers coming to case scope, but it's been predominantly a male, dominated field. And so I would love to see a more of a balance there from women as well. So what is Oracle doing to make it a more, parent-friendly environment that meets the needs of both men and women who want to be involved parents?
I mean, the broader Oracle, I'm sure there's a lot going on. I don't really keep in touch with everything. So there's a lot of activity going on within Oracle. There are groups within Oracle where women in our group also participate in to give feedback loops and take help from. I think there's within our own groups, I think what I would say is that we are encouraging a lot of women candidates to apply and be interviewed. Quality is paramount, but I think it's important that we have a good balance to have representation, because obviously women bring in a different perspective to the software itself, right? So that's something. And it's not like it's, when I talked about product management development, when we go to the broader ecosystem we interact with, there's a lot of women out there. You don't see them at K-Scope, but if you go to the UX team, for example, there's a lot of, almost everybody who I interact with are women. So they are great, right? Awesome to work with. And so you may not see many people at K-Scope who are represented, okay, which is kind of should change, hopefully. But I can assure you, within Oracle, there's a lot of representation who I interact with directly.
Fantastic.
Well, now we come to the fun part of this conversation. The rest of it was fun. Hopefully the rest of it was fun. The torture chamber, hopefully not.
The torture chamber.
So we like to do things in threes. This is our classical education coming to the fore. Could you name three people, three historical figures, anyone that you'd like to meet? If there was a magic wand that would make this possible, who would that be?
I would say it is. I'm just going to prick across different spectrums just to keep it interesting. First would be E.O. Wilson. I don't know if you know E.O. Wilson. He was a Harvard professor of, he's a biologist and biodiversity specialist. He passed away in exactly, I think, December 2021. He wrote the book Ants and the Man. And also, I was introduced to him through my wife, who's a biodiversity specialist. But she gave me a book on that, and I just caught on to that. It's a very interesting, because I think we didn't dwell into that much in this conversation, but I'm always been curious right from childhood on a lot of things, on how things work together, right? How we have evolved to be what we are, how things work together. I was always fascinated with either the technology aspect or the mechanical aspect of anything which I observed, or I do a lot of photography, I do a lot of nature hiking. So just nature in general, or anything I see around, I'm always curious how they all connect to each other. And I think Yo Wilson is a great author and great person whose books I've learned a lot from. I think he would be one person I think you should probably look him up and read up, because it just helps you explain human evolution so much better. And just explains, and it helps me even in my job, because it just explains how to relate to people, because I can think of them as evolutionary beings. And so, you know, in terms of color, religion, or culture, those all kind of go away when you think of each other as human beings talking to each other, and how we evolve to be and how we relate to other species. So that's what his focus area is. And that's kind of a lot of my interest. And so that would be one. The second would be, I think from a technology standpoint, Steve Jobs would be a great example, right? Because his value for perfection and in terms of product has kind of, I think it's a benchmark to look up to. I've seen a lot of movies and books around Steve Jobs, and there's obviously two sides to it in terms of how you view Steve Jobs. But I think there's a lot of aspects to him you can admire and try to emulate in terms of how you look at a product. And then the third would be, I would say, from a different spectrum, Gandhi would be one, I guess, just in terms of the perspective, because of his own perspective going into South Africa, to UK, and then in India, and how he gave up what he gave and how he could channel all that energy as one human being. So that would be interesting. Those three would be coming in from different angles.
Those are very different people. Very much so. How about books and movies? That's the historical side of this. Is, I guess, the kind of pop culture, kind of not pop culture perspective.
So I'm going to be probably boring on the book side. I do read fiction, but I think I kind of lean towards more nonfiction. I mean, early in the teenage time, I used to be an Ayn Rand fan. I pretty much devoured her books, The Atlas Shrugged and Fountainhead, and you name it, any Ayn Rand book I had, and read through it. But I think I evolved from there on into, I think one book which early on I caught on to, which still I hold in high regard, Shoemaker's book, is Small is Beautiful. It's an economics book. Economics always fascinated me because of the same reason why, Yo Wilson fascinates me for the connectivity between things. So I really wanted to understand how things connect to each other. So I was always curious about economics. And Small is Beautiful is a great example of how things which matter and actually make it work in a small, right? And we talked about Hyperion versus a broader company. So things work better. And that's kind of the gist of Small is Beautiful. When things are smaller, they're easier to deploy. There's less wastage. There's less. But I think we have gone beyond that. But it's a good book. It's a 1973 written book, but it's still applicable in terms of its ability to communicate. Because we are different sizes of countries, and what works in one country doesn't work in another. And I think that's the gist of what his statement is, that you can't apply tech technology and economic theories from one country and apply it across other countries with different density of populations. So that's another one. I think the third one is, again, boring from a technology or from where others might be coming from, is John Kenneth Galbraith, again, an economics book. Which I've read way back in my college days, but it really helped me understand. It's a book on American capitalism. It's called The Countervailing Power. I think that's what its title is. It's John Kenneth Galbraith was an agriculturalist from Canada who became an economist from University of Toronto. And you can look him up, but it's really helped me, because this was pre-internet days, and it helped me understand a lot about Western economies back when I was in India. And it still is very valid. It was a book written in 1950s. I think it got republished in 2012. but it's a great book to give you a sense of how power and economies work together in terms of progress, right? So it's really puts you a good perspective in terms of understanding why our economies are the way they are and what can we do to change them. So those three, I would say, from a book standpoint. I know it may not be the typical books from a fiction standpoint. Yeah, but those kind of come to mind.
I have to confess, I read Atlas Shrugged about a year ago. I don't know. You said you read the book a long time ago.
I understood the ideas,
but that has to be some of the. It was really bad. The writing was really awful. It was like being beaten over the head again and again.
That was in teenagers.
It was interesting. Points, but wow, from a reading perspective,
I think one thing. I mean, I would just cheat and go for the fourth one. I think one thing I missed out was Tower of Physics from Fijof Capra, right? That I read when I was, I think, 18 or 19 years old. And that was an astounding book, which really set to where I started thinking in terms of connectivity between things, because that really brought together Fijof Capra, as a physicist from, I think, Finland. He brings together Eastern philosophies and Western sciences together and matches up why you need both. And it kind of feeds the way he brings, because he's obviously coming from a physics background, very pure science background, but he understands how Eastern philosophies work, and he's able to marry the two. So Tower Physics is one of the, it's a bestseller, I think, but it was one of my first exposures to really the interconnectivity between things, and it still holds good. I go back and read it when I get time.
Yeah, I can see how this stream of connections goes throughout your intellectual life and your professional one as well.
Oh, and you said movies, right?
So, yeah, please.
Oh, movies. I think the one which tops the list, and it'll always, I think, stay there for a long time, is Shawshank Redemption. I can keep watching that movie and never get bored of it. The Tim Robbins movie. I don't know if you have seen it, but...
Oh, yeah, that's one of my favorites.
That's a movie. It's just a life learner. It has so much subtext to it in terms of what you can glean out of it in terms of life learnings. Because that whole movie is a metaphor in terms of what it's trying to communicate. And whenever you feel a little bit down or upset about with some people, you just go and watch those few scenes with Morgan Freeman. and it just is lifting your spirits kind of movie. So that will always stay at the top of my list for some time now. I think the other one would be, I think you guys may not have heard of it, again, from a different genre, would be Bang Bang Club. I think it was a 2010 movie. It was made by a Canadian South African director, Steven Silver, I think. Steven Silver. It portrayed the four photographers. You guys may know it, may not know it. I do a lot of photography. I had a lot of background in it from way back when, but I was into social documentary photography quite a bit. Did a lot of fun 9/11. But Bang Bang Club is about four photographers covering the apartheid in South Africa, and it was a story about them. So that really,
I've seen it.
You've seen it? Okay, yep. Great.
I
don't hear many people who have watched that one. So great.
Maybe about South Africa. I find it interesting.
And third one would be from a totally different genre, would be Heat, the 1995 movie with Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. That one is obviously a more action thriller, but it's just keeps you always rooting for that Robert De Niro character. You want him to survive and escape, right? So it's one of those movies which you root for the underdog in that and want to have him succeed. Yeah, that always, I never get bored of seeing it again and again.
Yeah, I think I've seen that a bunch of times, yeah.
Yep. So I would say from two different genres, those three stand out.
Well, Shankar, thank you. I have to say that I I found this a really fascinating conversation. All of our guests are interesting. You're at the very tippy top. There's so much about you that I didn't know before. I truly, truly enjoyed it, and I think our audience will enjoy it as well. So thank you. Thank you to my co-hosts as well.